meeting of the House Judiciary Committee for Friday, the 2nd of February, 2007. We're going to be holding a work session on one bill that I expect will go very quickly. And then for public hearings, we'll be taking hearings in the opposite order from the way they're presented here, 2302 and then 2102. I understand that there is a funeral procession that is going to be coming by the front of the Capitol at 9 o'clock, and so we're going to go into recess. This is for one of our fallen soldiers. We're going to go into recess just a few minutes before 9 so that members of the committee can go down for that, and then we'll return and go back into the resume our public hearing, assuming that it's still in progress. So I will open a work session on House Bill 2122, and Council Taylor, if you could remind us where we are.
Members of the committee, you have the -1 amendments in front of you. Allows an agency to delegate authority to enter final order in an administrative proceedings to an officer or employee of the agency or class of officers or employees of the agency. Delegation must be in writing and may be for the issuance of the order. Agency must retain the delegation in its records. The amendments replace the bill. Which is a whole of
yeah, and members, you may recall this is clarify the delegation of authority so that it's clear that not all agency orders have to be signed by the director or the head of the agency, but that the original bill as introduced was not clear that a delegation could be to a position as opposed to an individual, so that would require a new delegation every time there was a change of personnel in those positions, and it also required an acknowledgement by the individual, and that acknowledgement requirement has been removed. So you see the -1 amendments reflecting that change. Any discussion? If not, do we have a motion on the -1 amendment?
Mr. Chair, I make a motion that we move forward House Bill 2122 with a due pass recommendation with the chair.
Actually, first we need to move the -1
amendment. -1 amendments.
Very good. Representative Wisnett has moved the -1 amendments into House Bill 2122. Is there any objection? Hearing none, the -1 amendments are in. Then make a motion on the main bill.
Mr. Chair, I make a motion that we move HB 2122 forward with due pass recommendation. The chair has amended. Do you want a consent agenda?
Yes, I think this would be appropriate consent agenda.
On the consent agenda, Mr. Chair.
Okay, the Representative Wisnett has moved House Bill 2122 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation to be placed on the consent agenda. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Bonavici.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative
Flores.
Aye.
Representative Conk.
Aye.
Representative Freeberg.
Aye.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker.
Aye.
Chair Wisnett.
Aye.
Chair McPherson.
Aye.
House Bill 2122 as amended is moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation to be placed on the consent calendar. I'll now close the work session on House Bill 2122 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2302.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2302 requires the Criminal Justice Commission to identify special options for reducing the number of prison admissions for adjusting sentence length for a specific group of offenders if the state corrections population will exceed available capacity within 2 years of the date of forecast. Requires the commission to review the research regarding each option and no later than 3 months after receiving the forecast, submit its report to the governor and those legislative committees with jurisdictions over sentencing, basically the House and Senate Judiciary Committees.
Okay, we have several witnesses signed up, and because this directly affects the Criminal Justice Commission, I think we'd like to hear first from Craig Prinz.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2302 is a bill that allows for planning of prison construction, allows for looking at the timeline of when the forecast is going to overreach the prison bed capacity, and directs the commission to give the legislature, the judiciary committee, options to slow that growth if you want to have those options. It has a 2-year horizon, and that's so that when we are in a situation like that we'll have enough time to analyze the prison bed impact of different sentencing changes, and then most importantly, analyze the public safety impact to see, you know, so we can have a comprehensive public safety plan that we can look at investing in prisons and programs to reduce recidivism and, you know, prevention programs, and have it be something that, is analyzed with enough time to make changes if the legislature wished to. This also directs the commission itself, and not just me and my staff, to look at the options, to analyze them, vet them, and gives it a gives that process a form. Currently, what happens is, in my experience, a bill will be introduced that will either raise or, you know, increase the forecast, which would require more prison beds, or reduce in some way sentences, and that occurs at the legislature, and my staff is asked to give the fiscal impact of it. And that is something that just the staff does, and it's really done kind of, well, it's usually done during the legislative process. This would give it a trigger so that we would actually have the commission itself analyze those options and to see which things are the most cost effective. The commission is set up so that we've got different types of people with different backgrounds. We have a former U.S. attorney, current assistant U.S. attorney. We've got a former legislator who was on the guidelines council when the guidelines were originally put in. We have a district attorney. We have a former defense attorney. We have a chief of police. And we have the founder of No Meth, Not in My Neighborhood. This would direct that commission to analyze things that could be done to slow the growth if the legislature wanted to do that and change when the next prison would need to be built. That is the sentencing guidelines. I think that's one of the things that was based upon, was trying to make sure that we understand that we have what capacity we have, and that the sentencing schemes we have are in line with that capacity. Really, Mr. Chair and members, the only other thing I would say, you know, our revenue streams are unpredictable for general fund, and sometimes you need, well, if you don't do some planning, and you won't have any choices to make, and so this would give an opportunity to just have options on the table, and that's really what it's meant to do, is give an opportunity for planning. So if you have any questions, I'd be happy to try to answer them.
Mr. Prince, I think it might be helpful for you to summarize for the committee. I know that this is going to be a repeat for some members, but to just describe what the prison Department of Corrections inmate population has been in the state historically for the last 15 years, and what the projection is for the next 5, 10 years.
Mr. Chair, the prison forecast is that the current population is about 13,500 that are in custody. I think if we looked at it from where it's been in the last 25 years, from 1980 to 2005, I think that we'd see it's doubled about since 95. And if you looked at it from 80 to 2005, I think the way I look at it is we've tripled the incarceration rate. And the good news is that the growth of the forecast has begun to slow down. So that right now we're in a position where the Department of Corrections is not coming in this session to ask for funding to build the next prison yet. The prison that's currently underway at Deer Ridge should be adequate. And that hasn't always been the case. The growth that we were experiencing made it such that I think each session for the last few years, the DOC needed to get that the funds from the legislature immediately to build the next prison. So what I would characterize the growth now is that it's slowed, and that means that that the legislature has an opportunity to look at that. I don't think you'd have to make big sentencing changes to affect, you know, in time when the next prison would be built, if that's something you wanted to do because of, you know, the situation with what the revenues are expected to be.
Okay. Mr. Chair. Representative Krieger.
Thank you. Greg, with Measure 11 going in when it did, can you tell us a little bit when these people started getting out and what you think the projection is over time, how that's going to affect that population?
Sure. Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, I think that what we've seen, and this is something that's borne out in the forecast that the Office of Economic Analysis does, is that we had faster growth of the prison population from 95 to about 2000. And that was because through Measure 11, because those sentences were longer, Measure 11 was passed in 94, the offenders that were sentenced under Measure 11 were not getting out. If you look at the forecast now, the forecast has slowed, and I think a big part of that is because not only are people getting convicted and sentenced under Measure 11 and going into prison as an admission, but they're starting to come out. And so the net increase is balancing out. And I would say that is really what's changed the to a great magnitude has changed the forecast currently.
Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Prinz, you indicated that one of the functions of the Criminal Justice Commission is to analyze programs to reduce recidivism. Now, does the commission function as a repository to collect information on the various public, nonprofit, profit, or other entities that provide services and other assistance for people who are coming out of the system?
Mr. Chair, Representative Flores, I would say that the repository function that we have is really more about keeping crime data. More, it's the state and federal crime data. I think what you're asking, Representative Flores, is do we have the recidivism information from the programs themselves about which ones reduce recidivism? And I think the answer to me is there's so many programs we couldn't possibly analyze each program to see, you know, what the effect on recidivism is. But what we can do and what we do is we look at the literature and look at rigorous studies that have been done on different things like drug courts or in custody drug and alcohol. And if you look at those rigorous studies, you can see what the effect on recidivism is. So I hope that answers your question. Is we can look at the studies that have already been done and analyze them and see what the expected result would be. And then we can study in the future, we could study specific programs, say a specific, I think you said a specific nonprofit program, but right now we don't have the capability to study each of those programs because there's so many of them.
Follow up, please.
You may.
Thank you. Thank you. That does get to part of my question, and I think probably fleshing it out would be helpful, and that is when we're talking about the system, we have people coming out of corrections perhaps with a felony conviction. Having gone into the system with a felony conviction, they have any benefits that they might have been receiving terminated. We send them out, and they have to report to a parole and probation officer. They have to find a job. They have to find housing. They have to find these things. But we leave them without the resources to do these things. So the analysis of what would be the most effective program is probably not exactly where I'm trying to go, but in order to help facilitate hooking up these people in a way that would not induce them to go back into a life of crime because they find themselves in a helpless situation.
Mr. Chair, Representative Flores, to answer that, I think I understand what you're saying. I think that the, you know, public safety planning, you basically have prison investments, program investments, and then to some extent investments in police, although most of that's local investments. And trying to understand what, where's the most cost-effective way to deal with those issues so that we have the right mix or the right balance is, I think, what the literature can help us with. And so that we don't get into a situation where if we, once we spent on one area, say prisons, we don't have anything left, that there's no, you know, finances left to fund the part that makes sure or tries to make sure that they don't come back and that there's not barriers for them to reenter. And so I think that is where the literature is helpful. And then what you can do from that is get an idea of how much those different programs can be expected to reduce the them coming back.
Mr. Chair, I just think we need to have a conversation offline.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Representative Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Greg, I mean, I'm reading this thing and just going into shock last night, and it appears to me that what you're looking at is like, geez, they're getting crowded, so we're going to start cutting sentences. We have truth in sentencing in Oregon, which is vital. I lived as a cop through the 80s when somebody would get sentenced for years and years to prison, and in 2 years they'd be out killing and maiming. And I'll tell you a name that still rings in my head is Tyrone Wong, who I had arrested as a kid numerous times. He went to prison. He got out, and he beat a woman up after he'd been out 7 days. He broke every bone in her face. I wish I had the photograph to show the people here. And it still wouldn't do what sitting there that night with her was. He sentenced to prison for many years. 2 years later, a friend of my, one of my brother-in-laws had been laid off and took a job at a plaid pantry in the 2200 block of North Killingsworth. Tyrone Walton is out of prison again, goes in there, thinks the guy's tripping an alarm when he's robbing him, and he shoots and kills a father, husband, the bread earner. I mean, we went through this before. If it, just to me, what I'm reading there is we're looking at let's cut sentences and gee, I mean, I'll paraphrase Shakespeare, wreak havoc and loose the dogs of crime. I mean, I have an amendment. I've been trying to come up with an amendment to this. I'm really concerned. We need to do things up front and not have people going into prison. We do need to have drug and alcohol to help those people so when they get out and they go on. The job thing's going to be tough. I mean, Intel's not hiring people coming out of the joint.
President Barker, we're at about 5 minutes till, and I think people wanted some time to get all down right to the drive-by procession. So we're going to do, if it's all right.
I mean, certainly.
I know you want a response from Mr. Prinz, and I do too. So, but I suspect it'll be a little longer response than we probably have time for now. So why don't we go into recess, and then we'll resume with Mr. Prinz immediately at the end of that.
Okay.
So I'll recess the public hearing on House Bill 2302. We'll resume in a few. Judiciary Committee for Friday, the 2nd of February. We have Craig Prinz before us, as we did at the recess on House Bill 2302. We're resuming the public hearing on that bill. And we were, I think, a question from Representative Barker.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Chair, I'll just wrap up briefly. I'm just really concerned that this may be leading to somewhere I don't want to go, and I don't want to see the state go, and I'm concerned about the victims in Oregon, and I know you do as well, and so I believe this bill needs a little more work, and I'm going to work on an amendment and be glad to work with you. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Barker. I appreciate that, and I appreciate you recognizing that. I think I think we're all trying to avoid people, something like that tragedy happening. And I also wanted to point out that the work of the Criminal Justice Commission has actually shown that incarceration is something that reduces crime. I mean, it's part of the mix. I think that, I don't think the question is, can you reduce prison sentences and lower crime? I think the question is that the only place to invest all the money, or should we look at, if we had a savings here, c- Could we invest it in something like community corrections, supervision, treatment, getting jobs? You know, those are the questions that I think that the commission could explore, and that my staff could provide the technical expertise to look at the cost effectiveness of different things. So, and I appreciate your Representative Barker, your statements, and I share the same thing with you, that I want to I want to figure out the best way to protect the public.
Thank you,
Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question. I heard a statement the other day, and I'm not sure if it's fact or not, but that one of the things that California looks at for future prison population is third grade literacy. So we're talking about if you were looking at literacy rates in the third grade, that would be a prison population of 15 years from now. Or can you share us, is the commission, because my concern is that we're looking at we're putting in the statute a 2-year look, and that's when we're going to be reacting obviously to things we haven't planned for in the future. So can you share a little bit about that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, I heard that same thing, I think, and I forget which hearing it was, talking about the connection between literacy and crime. I think that we have to look at those early prevention programs, and I think that the hard thing for the legislature is, you know, that when the forecast is moving, that prison needs to be started now to get it done within 2 to 3 years. So I think we need to look at those things. I don't have an answer for you of what's the causal relationship between literacy and crime, but I think the issue that I would like to, I think the issue to address is, again, is there information out there that would say that investing in K-12 education or something like that also is a way to affect crime, reduce victimization, and is it a better way, or is it, can we do a better job? So I'd be happy to look into that. I think I was at the same hearing, and I'll try to get the information for you from California that they were referring to.
Thank you. Any further questions? Council Chair.
Members of the committee. Mr. Prince, I'm reading page 1 of the bill at the very end, and it says, indicates an inmate population will exceed available prison capacity within 2 years of the date of the forecast. Now, does that mean the prison space that we have now, or will that mean the prison space that we've projected to have in 2 years as far as the comparison goes?
Mr. Chair, Council, and I, gentlemen, for the record, Craig Prince, after the break, testifying on this. Mr. Taylor, I looked at the same issue. I think that if what I had thought, I mean, I think we need to clarify that maybe, because, for example, right now Deer Ridge is under construction. It's been funded by the legislature to get it started. It's under construction, but it won't be done, I think, until I have to ask the Department of Corrections, and then when can we actually use it? So I think that's something that we could clarify in that. And I saw the same issue.
Thanks.
I guess building a prison is not a single place in time. There's the planning it, the funding it, the building it, hiring up the correctional officers, and then actually being able to use it. So I think that could be clarified.
Any further questions? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Prinz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Steve Dole.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Steve Dole. I'm president of Crime Victims United of Oregon. I'm here to testify on House Bill 2302. We are not here in principle to oppose this thing, but we believe it needs to be amended. And I think Representative Barker is actually going to offer those amendments to the bill. I've provided a portion of a presentation that we make on Measure 11, and it has to do with the violent crime rate in the state of Oregon. You know, a few minutes ago I was struck by something as I stood out and watched the funeral procession for Ryan Hill. We've lost 3,000 plus young men and women over in Iraq. But between 1977 and 1995, we lost over 427,000 people on the streets of the United States who were murdered. I know one of those people very intimately, and I've grown to know the families of many of the people very intimately. We're never going to stop crime. It's always going to be with us. The question is what are the rates of crime that we should be forced to live with? And that's a question that you have posed to you. You know, that 427,000 figure that I used, that's more people that we lost in ground troops in World War II, Vietnam, the Gulf War, the current war, and all the small wars in between. That's a fact. And where was the outrage? Well, the outrage finally came in the late 80s and early 90s through the people of this country and through the initiative systems and through the legislatures, and they said enough is enough. When 33 states increased time served for violent criminals, 23 states invoked three strikes and you're outlaws, and by 1994, when Measure 11 was passed, virtually every state in the union had some form of minimum mandatory sentencing law on the books. So now what are we doing? We're saying, hooray, we were successful, let's tear it all apart. Let's go back to 1960, and I'd ask you to look at this graph for just a minute. You see where the crime rate was in 1960? I don't know where you folks were in 1960, but I was a 10-year-old boy in fourth grade at St. Cecilia's High School in North Portland. From 1960 to 1985, we witnessed a 800% increase in the rate of violent crime. And I'm going to tell you something. That steep increase that you see, I'm going to lay right at the foot of this body. Now, I know you weren't in it at the time, but I'll tell you this right now. Look at the top of the graph and look how many prison beds we built. Turn that graph sideways and look how many prison beds. Look what the response of the legislature was to an 800% increase in the rate of violent crime. It was gross negligence, in my opinion. So with that, I would say this. You know, with all the overreaction and talking about how many people we're locking up, let's remember this, that we're 34th in the rate of incarceration in the United States. Before Measure 11, we were 42nd. I wouldn't exactly say that's going crazy, locking up people. But nobody asks about the big elephant in the room. Why are we have we always been in the top 10, even before Measure 11, in the cost of incarceration? That's what we should be looking at. With no Measure 11, we'd be 49th in the rate of incarceration today. So, and as far as alternatives to incarceration, I'd ask you this, and Craig Prinz could back me up on this, and so could the Department of Corrections. 74% of convicted felons get probation in this state. 74%. So we send 26% of convicted felons to prison, and almost 70% of those are violent criminals. You know, if you're a property criminal, believe me, you got to have a long list of property crimes. You got to work hard to get into prison in this state. So I would say this in conclusion: I'm offering an amendment because we talk about we have a quality education model that they're using in this state. Well, we're also going to have a quality public safety model, and I'll tell you what you're going to be judged on is that red line. As long as that red line keeps going down, good job. But remember, when you make a turn and that thing starts doing this, the public's going to know about it because we're not going to let it happen for too long. So the amendment I would offer is this, and I'm going to read it to you, please. That we add a section 2 to this bill that says, in fulfilling its duties as required in this section, the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission shall not recommend the reduction of any sentence for any crime, including but not limited to increased good time, work time, alternative incarceration program, furlough, or other form of early release, unless evidence proves that the reduction in the sentence will result in a reduction of the crime rate and victimization. And I appreciate you listening to me, and I would be happy to take any questions.
Any questions for Mr. Dole? Mr. Dole, let me ask you about this. I don't have the text of what you just read, but let me just ask you about this. So your amendment would require an affirmative showing that of an improvement in public safety before there could be a change, rather than saying that we would stay even. Is that right? I attended the Public Safety Ways and Means presentation that was made here several days ago, in which Mr. Oss from Washington was describing a model they're pursuing up there, in which just to summarize kind of very broadly what the thrust was that there is a way that the path they're on in Washington State is to avoid an increase in incarceration with no increase in the crime rate. Since saving public dollars so that we can spend them on universities and K-12 education and public and social services would seem to be a desirable thing to do if we can do it at no cost to public safety, wouldn't a neutral impact be sufficient? Why would we need to show that there would be a reduction in order to proceed in this path?
Well, because I don't think we've finished our job. At some time, we might want to talk about a neutrality. I think one of the things that was left out of the Oss conversation, I was also their representative, and that is, and that he didn't talk about, I think he touched on it, but I've talked to some people in Olympia about this, and they're looking at this right now, and that is how the populations balance out from a demographic standpoint as to crime type in Washington versus Oregon. This is what this is the problem you get into when you start comparing states. You're not comparing oranges to oranges. One of the things you'll find in Washington's prison population is that they imprison over 20% of their prison population are drug offenders. We've got, I think, and Mr. Prince can correct me, I think it's somewhere around 9 or 10%. And in our prison system, you have to be manufacturer or a distributor, better known as a drug dealer, to get into prison in Oregon. You don't get in for using. And in Washington, you can get in for possession and use. So what I'm saying is one of the things they're looking at that he didn't talk about is they're going to ramp up sentences up there. And I'll tell you what they're ramping up. They're going to ramp up sentences for violent criminals because they know they've got a deficiency there. So that's my answer. I think we remember this too, that while we've seen this significant drop in the rate of violent crime, Oregon led the nation for several years, for about 8 years in the rate of reduction of violent crime, while the rest of the nation witnessed a 28% decrease. We witnessed a 44% decrease. And I would submit this: I'm never going to stand in front of you to tell you that was all due to Measure 11, but the substantial portion of it was due to Measure 11. But consider this, that while the crime rates are falling, that Oregon, for the last 17 years in property crime, we have been one of the top property crime states in the nation. We have bounced between, if number one is the highest rate of property crime in the nation, we've bounced between number 5 and number 14 for the last 17 years. We're currently number 6. That's according to the FBI figures. Now, my question is this. This is before meth was the drug du jour. So what has our response been? Well, it's been negligible, and we've had all these years since Measure 11 to apply all this science and all this evidence-based research and all these treatment programs, and it certainly hasn't affected the property crime rate. It's because, again, I could go out and do burglaries all afternoon for the rest of the day, and guess what? I'd probably either get probation or, at the very, very worst, I might serve 6 months in prison.
Any more questions, Mr. Dole? Thank you.
Thank you.
Next on our list, Kevin Mannix.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Kevin Mannix. I'm an attorney in private practice in Salem. And since this is my first visit with the committee this session, I'd give you a brief background description. I am a former legislator. I served 5 terms in the House and a partial term in the Senate. And I also am proud of the fact that as a legislator, I was the chief sponsor of 135 successful pieces of legislation over those 10 years. In addition, I have been involved in the initiative process. I am the author of Measure 11, the mandatory minimums for violent crime, Measure 17, which requires that prisoners work full-time in useful work in our state prisons, and the original Measure 40, which after court action had to be sent out again, and those are the key parts are the victims' rights amendments to the Oregon Constitution. As a legislator, some of my legislation included Oregon's identity theft law, our anti-stalking law, and our murder by abuse statute. So I've been very attentive to the criminal justice system in the state. I come to you today in regard to House Bill 2302 for 2 reasons. One are the specifics of the bill. One has to do with the specifics of the bill. The other reason has to do with the philosophy of the bill. As to the specifics, the bill needs to be amended simply because all that it does right now is figure out how far we retreat in the war against crime. That is, if the signals are that we're going to have to increase prison capacity, if they see that signal, this bill says, Criminal Justice Commission, tell us how high we should raise the white flag, or tell us how far we should retreat. It doesn't say anything in here about how do we modify the incarceration system so that we can make more effective use of the incarceration system. Are we maximizing the capacity of that system? Are we using enough prison farms or prison work camps or forest camps? There's nothing in here about. The options are, how do we reduce sentences and back away? Other options need to be put into this bill if it's going to be a correct statement of mission for the Criminal Justice Commission. And I'd be happy to work with the committee or Representative Barker, anyone that wants to amend this bill, to make sure the panoply of options are presented to the legislature when there is a concern about the capacity of the prison system. And the philosophical question that arises in House Bill 2302 is we need to remember that this is the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission. All of us who believe in a holistic approach to crime understand that the Criminal Justice Commission is not the only commission that can help us address these issues. Take a look at the Commission on Children and Families. If we're going to talk about prevention, a good deal of the prevention will occur in the communities, in programs that help children and families, and in education. We all need to understand that and not think that the Criminal Justice Commission can get its arms around all the things that we're going to do. In fact, I would put a directive in here that from time to time this commission needs to meet with other commissions, such as the Commission on Children and Families, to find out what they're doing. And please understand that a dollar invested today over there in the Human Resources Committees has a much bigger impact long-term on the overall crime rate in the state than a dollar invested in this committee in its activities. And I understand that. On the other hand, the citizens of the state demand that certain people who are predators be incapacitated so that they can't hurt other people, and that they be held accountable so that victims feel that society recognizes their pain and their hurt, and that society will hold those perpetrators accountable with an appropriate sanction. Sometimes prison, sometimes county jail, sometimes parole, probation, and all the other things. And the Criminal Justice Commission should be charged with looking in a holistic fashion at the criminal justice system to make sure that victims are recognized and that society is protected. There is no magic formula in any given state, but we have touched a few positive buttons in Oregon, and we do know that violent crime went down dramatically in Oregon when we incapacitated violent criminals. I would suggest to you that our rampant property crime will also go down when we tell burglars and auto thieves and forgers and identity thieves that we are going to incapacitate them and hold them accountable, and that usually means time in a prison. But I'll hold myself back. I don't want to get too excited about talking about these options. I just want to remind the committee that, yes, There is an entire Capitol building. There are so many other important committees. And, yes, long-term, the state always needs to be making choices about what do we invest now in human resources and in education versus the correction system. And we'll be having those conversations all session, I trust. But for today, I ask you to please defer work on this bill and develop an amendment that recharges the Criminal Justice Commission to take a broader view of things when looking at the alternatives for the future. Thank you.
Representative Krieger.
Kevin, I represent Barker. I come from a background where, of course, we don't want people out on the street who have committed these crimes. And I've been in the prison. I've been in this system now for three terms. And I agree with where both you and Steve are going, but I think maybe this body has been negligent. We can get them into prison, but we really don't prepare them to come out. And you're talking about the investment in human services. And a lot of these people don't get the treatment that they need. They don't even get the education opportunity. Then they can't get housing, and they come right back into the system again. It costs about $50,000 to bring one back in. Can you maybe talk a little bit about how you vision that maybe we could drop that recidivism rate, which you can do a lot of education for $25,000 or $30,000 a year that person's going to be in there when they're in there the first time to keep them from coming back. Can you address that in some way a little bit?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Krieger, first I'll go all the way back to, again, human resources and education and those other issues for long term. But then, yes, let's fast forward to that point in life when somebody has run afoul of the criminal justice system and has come to our attention. Swift intervention is important. Predictable intervention is important, and we don't always have that with what we call the lower-level offenders. If anything, the predictability is, hey, probation, you know, and we'll put you on the list and put the list on the shelf because we don't have enough people to supervise you. So there's some problems with community programs, and I'm not blaming the communities. That has to do with how you fund community corrections programs. And community corrections programs are a very effective alternative for many offenders, especially those who have first come to the attention of the system. And that is one area. Once you have someone in a county jail, understand, of course, that they won't be there for more than a year. And there's not a lot that you can do within a year's time to change a person's life that's already been damaged so much. There's some things you can do in county jails that put prisoners to some useful work, doing something helpful. Those are good things. And they are empowered to do that, by the way, by Measure 11. It requires the state to put prisoners to work. It authorizes counties to put their prisoners to work. In the state prison system, with the cutbacks that we suffered in the last few years, we saw a wholesale reduction of mental health and drug and alcohol rehab programs in the prison system. And frankly, relative to what goes out in the community, I would much rather spend those resources helping people who haven't committed crimes. And so if you had to make choices about where cutbacks occur, to be brutally honest about it, you say, well, we're going to help the prisoners less because we haven't got enough to help the folks who haven't committed crimes. Now, as we're readjusting our resources and looking at a capacity improvement, we need to get back to corrections and say drug and alcohol rehabilitation does make a difference. Work programs need to be useful, and they include some vocational training elements. Basic GED education, all of that's important. And then the transition programs. Corrections can't just open the gates and say hasta la vista, or, you know, check in with your parole and probation officer. That doesn't work anymore. They know that. They've got transition programs that are set up in concept, but they need the funding to implement them. Now, I grant you that you can't get all of that done overnight as you're reestablishing things, but you've got a corrections department that is actually a very good corrections department and could use your help in convincing the folks over in Ways and Means to reestablish funding for those programs. And I'll quickly add the alternative programs that are done at the community level, such as drug courts. Those are a great thing. So please don't misunderstand me today. I'm not saying don't do all those good things, but I am saying philosophically this bill doesn't get us where it should get us.
Any further questions? Well, I have one, Mr. Maddox. The bill acknowledges, because it requires a report from the Criminal Justice Commission back to the legislature and the governor, who are the policymakers. So none of these options that are identified by the commission could be implemented without legislative action. So we have a commission that is already charged with giving us policy advice on matters of public safety and our corrections population. So my question for you is that you mentioned these other commissions, but is the makeup of the Criminal Justice Commission slanted in some way? Is it an inappropriate makeup for making these kinds of recommendations to the legislature?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm not prepared to say that it's slanted in some way. I think that they attempt to have a good representation, but it's largely on the law enforcement side in some fashion, because it is the Criminal Justice Commission, just as a commission on children and families, if you want to call that slanted, it's towards the human resources, community resources side of things. I'm just saying that sometimes there needs to be a marriage of philosophy here, and a good communication is important. My critique has to do with, what are our options when we find out that we're going to reach capacity? Reduce the number of prison admissions for adjusting sentence lengths for specific groups of offenders and to analyze the effect of each option? So we're saying, you know, how many rounds of ammunition do we take out of the chamber? How about reevaluating how you determine the capacity of the system? How about maximizing the efficiency of the capacity of the system? And I mentioned earlier in my testimony, work camps, all kinds of things that can be done in a less costly fashion. So to me, the options ought to include, you know, the whole range. And let's remember, of course, these are options about what you do in the immediate sense, and I recognize that. When we talk about children and families, and we're talking about a 10 or 20-year time frame, that's one thing. That'll do something we hope to help us in socioeconomics for the long term. In the immediate sense, though, what do we do with the people that are out there right now that are predators? And to me, simply because we're reaching capacity in the system doesn't tell me that our response is to put less people into it. Maybe that's the response, and that certainly should be one of the options considered. But we're not considering the other options under the directive of this bill.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Mannix. I have what may be a question or a comment that's more appropriately addressed to Mr. Prinz, but I'll just throw it out there and see what you say. I'm having a hard time kind of understanding where this proposed language came from, because it, according to the existing Oregon Criminal Justice Commission language, they already have the responsibility to include public safety, offender accountability, crime reduction and prevention, and offender treatment and rehabilitation in their work. And their plan must include but need not be limited to recommendations regarding, and then it has all the issues listed. So I can't figure out where this language came from that we're talking about in this bill, and what the need for that is and where that arose, because it seems like everything is already included in the existing statute.
And actually, I think that's probably a good question to get a response on, but I think maybe Mr. Prinz would be the more appropriate responder, since he's who would know more about the history of the bill. Would that be all right, Mr. Mannix, if we were to bring Mr. Prinz back, although I'm not sure, he may have reframed the question here for him. The question is, we already have broad authorities here for the Criminal Justice Commission to undertake, you know, the kind of analysis that's described in subsection 2 of the bill, and then the bill here is to propose a specific analysis of based on prison forecasts. And I think that if I could paraphrase the question is there what's the need for this additional language when there are already this fairly broad authority here?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonamici, I think the answer is without this direction, it's hard to get a conversation like this started. None of us, my background is in law enforcement. Mr. Mannix said, I think most of them are in law enforcement. What happens without a direction like this from the legislature is it happens ad hoc at the last minute when I'm asked to analyze a bill. And I think it's more, when I say that, I don't know if you're aware, but the fiscal impact of a bill that'll either raise in some way the sentence length or reduce the sentence length the Criminal Justice Commission staff analyzes that. And I think that it's more appropriate to have a trigger and do this. And I think Senator Burdick, who's a non-voting member of the commission, wanted that to have that ability earlier to have that discussion by the commission itself. So I think that we have not really done that to this point. And I think as she's been, she's on the Ways and Means Public Safety subcommittee, listening to Mr. Ose that the chair mentioned, and I think it comes from that, wanting to have that dialogue. And I see it as a direction to do something that without the direction might not occur until the last minute.
Thank you.
May I join in that response?
Briefly, I think we've heard quite a bit already, but from the bill. But go ahead.
Well, I don't, Mr. Chairman, Representative Bonamici. I don't sit on the commission and have not visited with them in a long time. But in essence, what I discern from this is that the commission doesn't really want to go there unless they have to, unless they're told to, and that's my read. That's my read. And part of it is because I don't think they like the idea of going in this direction, and they prefer to go in another direction. But sometimes if you want them to go in this direction, you need to tell them to.
Thank you.
If there are no further questions, we'll excuse these witnesses. And Kevin Neely, I think, has to be on the list.
Thank you, Chairman Pearson. For the record, Kevin Neely, representing the Oregon District Attorneys Association, and specifically today I'm here because District Attorney Josh Markey couldn't be here, and I'm not sure there's anybody that could properly put words in Josh Markey's mouth, but I'll try to do so. I have submitted written testimony from District Attorney Markey, and I'm not going to take but a couple seconds of your time. What I can tell you is that District Attorney Markey, who does in fact sit on the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission, does oppose this bill as it's currently written. I don't think he opposes the idea that the commission takes a close look at the issues that the bill addresses. I think he just feels that, in fact, the bill is too narrow, as you've already heard from the individuals that have testified before me. Specifically, the bill only allows the commission, or appears to only allow the commission, to look at two things: identifying specific options for reducing the number of prison admissions or for adjusting sentence lengths for specific groups of offenders. Again, as I think you've heard from others who have testified before me, the Oregon District Attorneys Association and District Attorney Markey believe the breadth of this review, if indeed the commission is going to do this review, needs to include a wide array of additional factors that affect public safety. Thank you. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
I see no questions. Thank you, Mr. Neely. That concludes our public hearing on House Bill 2302. I'll close the public hearing and open a public hearing on House Bill 2102.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2102 comes to you at the request of Governor Ted Kulongoski for the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission. It makes the Law Enforcement Contracts Policy and Data Review Committee permanent, transfers responsibility for the committee from the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission to Portland State University, measure effective upon passage.
We have several witnesses signed up, and I think that Senator Walker was going to try to join us, but so we'll probably bring her forward as soon as she gets here. But first on my list, this is a commission bill, isn't it? Maybe we should hear from Mr. Prinz, since it says a commission at the request of the commission.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Switching gears to issue of racial profiling on traffic stops. I know that we're pressed for time, and I checked in also with Senator Walker's office. So this is a bill that transfers some of the duties of the Racial Profiling Committee to Portland State University, and most importantly, repeals the sunset that's coming up on that. That's going to come up on December 31st of this year. And so I've got several people signed up, and that's the basic background. And I think that the other speakers, if they could join me, could probably lay it out better than I could. But the background is, In 2001, Senate Bill 415, which Senator Walker was a proponent of, created what is called the Law Enforcement Contacts Committee, and that committee analyzes traffic stop information to look at the issue of...
Senator Walker, why don't you come and join Mr. Prinz at the this table?
Thank you. It's quite a sprint from my
getting your exercise this morning. I'm sorry, we kind of...
Thank you. Didn't mean to interrupt. Keep going, yeah.
So in 2001, the committee was created to analyze traffic stop data to look at basically the ethnicity of people that are stopped in traffic stops. The committee, some of the committee members are here, and I think they have good news to report, which is that we've found a federal grant. It's a National Highway Traffic Safety Grant through the Oregon Department of Transportation that can continue this work. And so the bill repeals that sunset. And about 2 years ago, because my staff was cut, I began contracting with Portland State University to really do the analysis. And Professor Renauer is here from Portland State. With one state agency being the recipient of a federal grant, and Portland State University already doing the analysis, I'm basically didn't see a reason to have two state agencies be granting streams if it's going to be based on federal funding. So the bill would take the Criminal Justice Commission out of that funding stream, and the federal funding would flow directly from the National Highway Traffic Safety to the Oregon Department of Transportation. And then to the, I think that the setup that you'll hear is that the committee would basically be the advisory committee for where this study should go, and Portland State would provide the technical expertise. So I hope that's
okay. And actually, I was slipped a note here that said that we didn't have you formally identify yourself.
I always
for the record.
To do that. For the record, I'm Craig Prinz, Executive Director of the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission.
And there's notes all over the table,
everywhere.
Mr. Chair, that remind people to do that.
And Senator Walker, why don't you begin by identifying yourself, and then after you and we have any questions given to me, you and Mr. Prinz, we can bring the other witnesses forward.
Thank you. I'm Vicki Walker, State Senator, District 7. Thank you for indulging me. I'm all about this bill. This was my bill in 2001. The NAACP, the local chapter in Lane County, had worked with me on this in the interim. And in the interim, I started out a little cocky, and we had to sort of regroup and be nice with one another, because it's easy to get upset about racial profiling. It's often called DWB, driving while black or brown. And there was a lot of it going on across the country, and people were pretty upset about it. So my community's actually been working very hard to prevent this from happening as well. So I came forward. We got the bill passed in 2001, and they've done tremendous work. And while I don't like to give work to Portland State when I have a university in my town, I think the FIT has done a really good job of making sure that we meet the conditions of what we set out to do. And we worked really hard on the language in 2001, and it wasn't pejorative, it wasn't derogatory, it was just very clear what we set out to do, and we stopped engaging in hyperbole. So I think we've done some really good work, and I'd like to continue, especially with grant money.
Well, I commend you on your leadership for this issue over time, and not losing heart. You know, sometimes people will embrace an issue, but then get discouraged and not stick with it.
Well, I appreciate that, Mr. Chair, and I have a box of files on this, and I didn't think this bill was up this session, and otherwise I would have had all my files, and I would have been able to quote you word for word whatever you needed to know, because you know I keep very good notes. But I've not gotten rid of that box, because it is important that we continue to be vigilant about preventing racial profiling.
Mm-hmm. Are there any questions? Representative Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You talked about driving while black, and I just wondered if you could tell the committee how much experience you've had driving a patrol car and stopping people at night and telling what race they were before you got up to the window.
Oh, well, I'm Mr. Chair and Representative Barker, I have no experience with that. My first experience driving a patrol car was yesterday out at the Department of Public Safety and Standards and Training when we got a little review about what they do out there. So, no, I've not had that. And I think that's why the committee was put together to address those issues and those concerns about what officers face and how an officer can make that decision. But this was sweeping across the country during that time. Some states are not very good at this. Some states do a lot of racial profiling. But we had a lot of good work here in Hillsborough, if I remember my files correctly. I just think we've done a tremendous job. So that's my answer.
Thank you. And Portland started, we had to log in on the computer after a traffic stop. And I hadn't really paid much attention before that, but I want to tell you, I was amazed the number of times I would think I had just stopped a whatever, and I would get up the car, and it was something totally different, either in race or sex or any, and all that. I support the bill, however. I think this is a good idea to continue this, but I just want to make the point that you don't know who you're stopping at night many, many times by race and sex, and you think you can see them in the car with your headlights on and lights coming from the other way. But I've been amazed, to tell you the truth, when I get up to those cars. So thank you.
I have no comment. You said you're welcome.
Representative Krieger.
Yeah. Good morning, Senator.
Good morning.
I believe I co-carried that bill with you on the floor. I was in Judiciary. I don't think you were. I can't remember if you were or not. But I know you spoke to it, and I know I spoke to it. And I agree with the basic concept, but since that time, I get up every morning about 5 or a little before, and I get my herbal tea going, and I'm watching the TV. And something I see in the news is this huge disproportionality of the crimes reported in the Portland area representing those people of color, whether it be Hispanic or black, compared to their population in that area. And I look at that and I say, why is that? And how do we expect the police officers to go out there and work under those conditions where that is the condition that they have and not somehow have that affect their judgment or their decision? I don't think the way you treat anybody is respectful, you know, being polite and all that. But that's been a problem for me. You know, I support the concept. I understand what we're doing. But at the same time, I see this disproportionality day after day after day. You know, Jose so-and-so shot somebody else. And it's day after day. You can take a look at it. It's just almost as bad as if you turn on the TV now. Day after day, somewhere in the United States, we've got somebody that's abducted some young woman or a child. So we want our police officers to protect us from those people. And if they are a disproportionate population that's committing these type of crimes, and I'm not, tell me how we assign them to do that and not actually take place some type of you call it profiling, I think it's a judgment whether this person is more apt to have done this because of what you see. Now, can you talk to me a little on that?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, that's a difficult thing to answer. I don't work in law enforcement. All I can tell you is representing my constituents, they felt at that time, and I think there are still some who feel that, and particularly you see that now in the post-9/11 world where you're having people of Mideastern origin profiled simply because they look like they came from Iraq or Iran or someplace else, and they're now being profiled, and you see that quite a bit. So it is. We have to be constantly ever vigilant about that fine line, which is just because they look black, brown, or Middle Eastern, or Asian, or whatever it is, or you know, female, male. We have to be vigilant about it. But you know, I just can't answer that for you. Law enforcement does a really good job, and I think the law enforcement contacts and policy data review committee, that was just the worst, longest name for a committee ever. I can never remember the full name of it. But, you know, they've done a good job about pointing those differences out so that law enforcement can develop programs and policies that respect the intent of what we're trying to do here.
Just follow up real quickly.
You may.
You know, I'm maybe a little humored at the thing, but, you know, our lives are made up of profile. You profiled your husband. He profiled you to make the choice that you were pretty. He loved you, your figure, your personality, your hair. When you go into the store, you pick up tomatoes, you squeeze them. You pick up the Charmin, you squeeze that. That's how we get, by profiling, is how we get things into our head to like or make choices. And we do it every day. You look at a steak. Is it marbled? Is it nice red or is it getting dark but in the case too long? You're profiling, you're observing, you're evaluating. And that's kind of what we do as human beings, everything. The chair of this committee profiled members to some degree, decided in conjunction with the Speaker of the House that, you know, Representative Reed, I think, has got the attitude in a year or two that he'd make a good House member in this committee. So different traits that we have cause us to be more valuable or less valuable. I'm sure I would be profiled if I wanted to be a pro basketball player at 5'10". The guy standing next to me is 7 foot. So we do that all through our lives, but we're going to eliminate it here. It's strange to me that we do that.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Krieger, I don't think I agree with you in total. I don't think that we profile people in terms of skills. You were analyzed for your skills, you weren't profiled because you were a white male, but you were looked at because your skills were serving on this committee in the past and you have law enforcement background. I'm assuming other people were looked at. They weren't profiled. Their skills were assessed. So I think there's a bit of a difference there.
Mr. Chair, just in closing, the movie White Men Can't Jump. Remember that?
Yes.
That's not a fun one. I agree. It's a difficult issue. It really is for everybody on both sides of the issue.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Krieger, for instance, I met Representative Cannon the other day. The first time I met him, he was sitting down. And the other day I met him, and he was standing up. And he is quite tall. And I think there's another member on this committee who is quite tall that I haven't met standing up. And I resisted with all great temptation to ask him if he ever played basketball, because tall people resent getting that question every single time they meet someone. And, you know, I was brought up short about that 20 years ago by a tall person who said, why do you always think that I'm, and that's profiling. So I resisted that temptation, and we talked about it, and he said that morning he'd been asked by two people. So stop asking tall people if they ever play basketball.
I've actually played miniature golf.
I didn't really have a question, just a comment. You know, my daughter still asks me how I reached the top shelf. You know, so short jokes have the same consequences.
Okay. If there are no further questions, then we'll excuse these witnesses. And we have, let's bring the remaining three people who are signed up. Annabelle Jaramillo from Benton County, David Fedanke from ACLU, and Ron Louie from the Hillsborough Police Department. If you could all join.
And Mr. Chair, I would be remiss if I didn't. I asked Troy Costales from the ODOT to be here, and he's in the back. I told him he didn't have to testify unless he had questions about the federal grant. So if there's questions about the grant, Troy's here for that.
Okay. We'll regard that as a resource. And I'd say in whatever order, the order of sign-up was the commissioner and then Mr. Pedanke and then Officer Louie.
Well, good morning, Chair McPherson, members of the committee. My name is Annabelle Jaramillo. I'm Benton County Commissioner. And, of course, two of my co-members of the Law Enforcement Context Policy and Data Review Committee are here. The chair of the committee, Chief Justice Edwin Peterson, was not able to be here. He's retired now and has taken on numerous other duties that occupy a lot of his time, and he asked me to be here in his stead as the vice chair of the committee. You've already been given some of the background on why this bill has come forward, and so I won't go into that, and I believe you have written testimony before you, so that can give you more detail. What I'd like to do is kind of talk a little bit about why we feel it's important for continuation of this particular committee. And it's based partly on its accomplishments, highlights of which are the following. surveying citizen perceptions of police fairness and reported traffic stops experiences over time will create a baseline to judge policies designed to impact police-citizen relations in Oregon. Surveying all law enforcement agencies in Oregon to study the history and character of traffic stop data collection will also provide data which can be used to judge progress over time. We want to develop learning principles and concepts for bias-based police training. And with that, we are embarked on developing scenarios related to bias-based policing issues for the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, new recruit academy. These training efforts provide us an opportunity to impact police-citizen relations in the future. What we've learned from these efforts also tells us there's a need for continuation. Specifically, numerous Oregon law enforcement agencies face obstacles that impede their ability and motivation to collect traffic stop data. Providing technical assistance will hopefully overcome such obstacles. Based on our data analysis, racial and ethnic disparities occur most often in decisions to search drivers. We need to learn more about search decisions, gather better data on the topic, and develop targeted training programs. We find there is no consistent training on racial profiling and bias policing occurring in Oregon at the present time. Our efforts will fill this gap. Although our analyses to date do not point to a conscious racial ethnic bias in law enforcement decisions to stop and search drivers and vehicles, citizen perceptions clearly indicate a portion of the population feels that police lack neutrality. We need to understand and address such perceptions. We conclude that Oregon law enforcement should continue to collect stop data and seek avenues for improving its level of specificity regarding stop characteristics. Also monitoring public perceptions of police biases, engaging in community outreach, and developing training curriculum for all organizational levels of law enforcement. In our work, we want to refine data collection points, such as capturing more information on types of searches. We want to continue developing and delivering technical assistance to Oregon police agencies on best practices in data collection, analysis, and reporting. We want to develop ongoing training for police agencies aimed at line officers and first-line supervisors, mid-management, and executive-level personnel pertaining to professional stops and non-biased policing. We want to increase the number of Oregon police agencies that are collecting data in accordance with the collection criteria set forth in Senate Bill 415, which was also enacted in 2001. We want to identify potential areas of community outreach based upon further work and analyses of stop data. And lastly, we want to continue participating in statewide surveys of attitudes about police and experiences with traffic stops. I appreciate your taking the time for listening to me, and I'm going to allow my two colleagues who are sitting with me. It's really nice to have law enforcement at your back many times, and I was pleased to see Chief Louis come and also Colonel Wilford with the State Police here, who's also on the committee, and my good friend Dave Pedanke from the SLU. So I'd be happy to answer any questions. They may have more answers in their presentations.
Gentlemen, in whatever order you choose.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, David Pedanke, Executive Director of the ACLU of Oregon. Following much of the conversation this morning with great interest, and Mr. Chair, I wanted to just provide a little bit more background for the committee on how the Law Enforcement Contacts Committee got started. It actually was an outgrowth of work that was done in the administration of Governor Kitzhaber. Back in 1997, Representative Barker and Krieger may recall that the legislature expanded the authority of police officers to engage in stops and frisks, and also to ask questions during traffic stops and request consent to search vehicles. That bill was House Bill 2457, I believe, in 1997. Some of us opposed that legislation because we thought it would increase bias-based policing in Oregon. And Governor Kitzhaber, in his wisdom, created a mechanism to get representatives of community organizations who were concerned about racial profiling and law enforcement representatives in the same room together. We spent the first 6 months kind of talking across the table at each other with those of us from community organizations saying racial profiling is a problem in Oregon and you need to deal with it, and law enforcement folks saying we are not engaged in racial profiling. And law enforcement folks were saying this is just an issue of public perceptions. Members of the public who don't understand what law enforcement officers face every day out on the street and how dangerous traffic stops can be for police officers and state troopers. And we were saying on the other side of the table, you know, regardless of what the intentions are of police officers, we believe that officers are making decisions that have a disproportionate impact based on race and ethnicity in their day-to-day policing decisions. And we got to a point where everybody agreed that both things were probably true, and that what was needed was to collect data about what was really happening out on the street, and also to begin surveying public attitudes in Oregon so that we weren't just making assumptions based on our impressions of news media coverage and other things. That has been going on now for a number of years in a number of jurisdictions. The leaders have been the city of Hillsborough and the state police in terms of collecting data on an ongoing basis. But we have also commissioned a number of public opinion surveys, including surveys that focused in on African-American population in Oregon and the Latino population in Oregon to look at public perceptions. And we've tracked those public perceptions over time now in four separate surveys that were done between 2002 and 2005. And assuming that this legislation is approved, we are planning to do another survey this year on public perceptions. But I want to, and there is a public perception, not just among people of color in Oregon, that there is bias-based policing taking place, but also among the white population, that officers are making decisions based on race unfairly. And let me give you, I want to just share with you the results of another question that we've asked over time, which I think illuminates public perceptions about law enforcement generally and the need for better community relations between law enforcement agencies and all of the populations they serve. We asked respondents in these surveys, do you believe that the reason the officer gave you for stopping you was the real reason they stopped you? Now, not surprisingly, among the minority population who responded to the survey in 2005, 42% said they believed that the real reason was something different than what the officer had told them. But among the population, the white population, that is the non-Hispanic white population, 25% of people who'd been stopped within the previous year said they thought the reason the officer had given was not the real reason. Now, I think that illuminates a real problem in Oregon, because when a fourth of Oregonians who've been stopped by police think that officers are not telling them the truth about why they were stopped, that highlights an issue that needs to be addressed. And it's one of the issues, just one of the issues, that we've been able to put numbers to in the work that this committee has done over the last few years, that shows the need for better training, for continued collection of information, both about public perceptions towards law enforcement and what's really happening out on the street, and to improve training and relationships between law enforcement agencies and the communities they serve. One last thing, Mr. Chair. I wanted to let you know that one of the provisions of the statute is, and it shows up on page 2, lines 30 and 31, and of course the members of this committee, who include both law enforcement, members of law enforcement, and public members, are appointed by the governor, and all of us serve as volunteers on the committee. And I wanted to point out one other issue, which is not an issue for me. I mean, I work for the ACLU. The ACLU pays for my mileage when I drive to Salem to attend committee meetings. But one member of our committee, who is the former director of the U.S. Bureau of Justice Statistics, Jan Chaykin, lives in Ashland. And thankfully for the state of Oregon, he decided to retire to Oregon. He's been doing great service on this committee at significant cost to himself. And it would be my hope that if the committee sees fit, that you would remove the language that prohibits reimbursement for expenses for members of the committee. It is not something that I would take advantage of, but it has been a hardship for Mr. Chaykin and would be for any member of the committee from Eastern Oregon in the future, and we hope to have one from Eastern Oregon in the future. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'll conclude my testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Pernanke.
Chief Ron Louis, Hillsborough Police Chief. Chairman McPherson and committee, just a brief summary. And, of course, representing law enforcement. In the year 2000, I had, and I'm going to get to the perception issue, we had, in Hillsborough, our population, Latino population, had dramatically increased from 13% till today, 2007, 24% of 85,000 people. Can you believe Hillsborough's 85,000 now? That are Latino. So in year 2000, I was having conversations with this emerging population, and this is unrelated to the committee itself at the time, and I had the perception issue. Many members of the Latino community saying, you know, my son, my husband, my father, continually stopped by police. We believe there's bias. So in a meeting in 2000, I was asked, Chief, do you know what your officers are doing out there? And my first response is, yes, they're doing the right thing. And are they biased? Are they like New Jersey, which you probably all know was singling out black male drivers on the turnpike to pull them over for drug interdiction? And I said, no, they're not trained to pull people over because of color. They're trained because of the behavior. And again, Representative Barker and Krieger know exactly what I'm talking about. We want the violation. But I didn't have any data to back it up. So we started collecting data in the year 2000, and I now have data on 110,000 stops in Hillsborough only. And when we took a look at the data, the pattern stayed the same. Now, the good news is Portland State took all of our numbers and gave them back to us. Because we police are terrible with statistics. So they gave us the numbers. They say cops use statistics the same way a drunk uses a lamppost, more for support than illumination. So I gave it to Portland State. Portland State gave it back, and they said, you know what? You do stop Latino males at a little greater rate, but you definitely search them more, and you find less. And we go, what? Because we're also dealing with the gang problem, large surge of Latino gang members. So we took a closer look at the data, and we did see an anomaly of all the male Latino drivers, 3% of them were searched, but we found less. We found more. And the reason I'm explaining this to you is this is where the data actually becomes useful for you. And the Department of State says, by the way, you're only stopping 1% Asian, there's 3% Asians. African-American drivers, they identify, Portland State even identified, it's not a residential issue, they're community intel engineers on along the causeways. So make a long story short, what we did do is we found out that there were some disparities. We tried to auger down more to those numbers. Gee, why are we stopping or searching Latino male drivers more, not female drivers, but Latino male drivers? Are we disproportionately stopping? And that's not the controversy, as you all know. What we did do is reframe everything. We're looking at the driving population, not just the census data. It does appear that we are stopping about 24% Latino surname people in Hillsborough, which roughly equates to our census, our updated census, I should say. But what we did do is we went back, talked to our officers without making them feel like they're being prejudicial. But many of them did report a couple things. And this is where the training helps. Many of the officers really weren't telling the people why they're being stopped. Just pulled them over and tried to get them to tell them something about what they just did, and then we'd write that down. What the Latino population was telling us, and the Asian population, at least tell us why you're stopping us, please. That turned out to be a huge issue, because when I went and met with minority members and groups in Portland as well as in Hillsborough, that was a number one issue. The other issue was, you know what? If you're going to stop me or my son, will you do me a favor? Give me a ticket? But don't stop my son five times telling him he looks like somebody you're looking for and then cut him loose. So here's the best way to summarize this. We did take the data and we continue to have conversations with our community. And this is where LACC, this committee, the Law Enforcement Contact Committee, has really helped out me and some of my other colleagues in law enforcement, in that we take the information and we at least use it to have the conversation with our community. In 2 weeks, I'm going to have a conversation with 200 people from a congregation who are 100% Latino, congregation, Seventh-day Adventist Church. And a couple years ago, we had the conversation. We've shown the data. They have spent more time in the patrol car, seeing what the officers do, and Representative Barker's right, at 2 in the morning, you don't know who you're stopping. You can't see the driver. However, you look at the behavior. You look at why you're stopping the person. So there has been a discussion of perception as well. But we do have to recognize that there's some anomaly in the data, and I agree with David Anke when he says you look at the information, but you also have to deal with the perception. You just can't dismiss it and say, we're not being prejudiced. Now, my history, I was trained as a police officer in Palo Alto. My training officer told me, you're in a white neighborhood. If they're not white, pull them over. And I go, well, I grew up in Chinatown, and I know I always got pulled over when I went across Van Ness Avenue. And by the way, when you grew up in Chinatown, you sit in pillows. But you sit on a pillow, and you look taller, and you won't get pulled over. So when we started wearing pillows, true story, and I don't play basketball, we started wearing pillows, they wouldn't pull us over when you go across Van Ness Avenue in the marina in the Richmond. So we knew that. The cops would always look for the short people. And that's just what you learn, growing up in the city. But coming from California, Oregon, I have found that Oregon law enforcement has been very professional about this. But what I have found is there is a strong need to have more conversations around our state with our minority community, with our growing population. The best way to have this conversation is the information we get from the LACC committee. That I couldn't ask for better. And I'm going to do it in 2 weeks. There may be some people in there going to give me their anecdotal why they were stopped numerous times. But at least I have the information where I can articulate what we have done, at least in our local community. Cornelius Police Department, Beaverton Police Department, other police departments are doing the same thing, same conversation, and using the support of the Law Enforcement Contact Committee to help them. So I'm here to give a plug and to say this also is an example of where we could have the ACLU and law enforcement and other members on the same committee working towards the same goal of just better understanding, knowing the data, and having a better conversation with our community. That's, in summary, where I see the value of this this committee. Thank you.
Committee, any questions for these witnesses? I guess I have just one for Mr. Podanky. You had mentioned a desire for an amendment, which would alter. It looks to me like it would be subsection 7, page 220, lines 29 through 31, where on line 30 it's a reference to no payment of expenses. That would of course necessitate an amendment, which would be at this stage in the session, because of all the bill drafting going on, would probably slow things down quite a bit. How strongly do you feel about that issue?
It could easily be handled in Ways and Means. I believe this bill is. Does it have a subsequent Ways and Means? No? Then we'll deal with it on the Senate side.
Okay, very good. Any further questions?
I just make one comment. I agree that it's very important when the perception is there and it is there. And these record keeping are great. I may have overreacted a little bit to what I consider a flip remark about driving a black. Having stopped many people over 31 years, I didn't do it because they were black. And I, you know, it's just the knee-jerk reaction. I apologize that I'm going to call Vicki Walker about that. But I support the bill.
Okay. If there are no further questions, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2102 and open a work session on House Bill 2102. The preference that I was hearing from Mr. Podanky was that we move the process along. They could deal with the expenses question at another stage in the process. So if people are comfortable with moving the bill at this point, we did have an offer of more information by Mr. Prince from a member of his staff about the grant that would fund the process. We didn't really get into that aspect of it, but we could invite, reopen the public testimony if we needed that input, but otherwise we'd be maybe ready to move. Is there a motion?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2102 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Barker moves House Bill 2102 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Bonamici?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Hoff?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Reed?
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnett?
Aye.
Chair McPherson?
Aye. I think this needs to carry it. Representative Barker, would you like?
I would like to carry it.
Okay, very good. Thank you for doing that. So House Bill 2102 is moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation to be carried by Representative Barker. I will close the work session on House Bill 2102, and that concludes our agenda. Thank you for your attendance, members. We're adjourned.